It's an American AM. I'm your host, Henry Raines. With me in the broadcast studio, Jim Delgado. I want to quickly remind you of this coming presentation. CZ Productions presents Keeping the Dream Alive, Monday, April 7th, 7:30 p.m. at the Golden Apple Dinner Theater in Sarasota. Presentation features educator, pastor, and activist Charles McKenzie in a one-man show retrospective of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s as seen through the eyes of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Charles McKenzie will portray Dr. King through the words of the great civil rights leader. General admission tickets are $35, and reserved seating is $40. Tea and coffee will be served, as well as snacks. The cash bar will be available. Tickets can be purchased at the Manatee Democratic Party headquarters, 5910 Cortez Road West, right next to the radio station here, or call 941-761-8385, 941-761-8385. Of course, the Golden Apple Dinner Theater is located at 25 North Pineapple in Sarasota, Florida. That's Keeping the Dream Alive, April 7th, 7:30 p.m. It's a Monday night. Charles McKenzie in a one-man show. And if you've ever heard Charles McKenzie speak, having him recreate Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. is going to be a real treat.
Which production company?
CZ Productions.
Is that who I think it is?
It's a newly formed company.
And is that his?
And
who, the CZ, the initials?
Anyway, but it is a benefit for the Manatee County Democratic Party.
All right. Brilliant. Is that his new hobby? I've heard about this hobby. I'm very excited about it.
Well, so am I.
Oh, we're not allowed to talk about it?
Well,
you give me that look.
Until you get the backstory.
Oh, beautiful.
But anyway, the show should be just incredible. Charles McKenzie actually is a young man. Not even as perhaps a man, but as a youth.
Uh-huh.
I think won a contest recreating Dr. Martin.
Did he really?
Yeah. Let's go to the phone lines.
And he's a good man. Real good man.
You're live on the air.
I didn't know exactly what you guys were talking about earlier. I just turned on the radio. But, as far as what you're talking about with the financial situation of the country, you don't hear very many people talking about it, but I was talking with a family member just last night, and in our opinion, it wouldn't be at all surprising to us if you saw a steep downturn in the situation for America financially in a very short period of time, like you mentioned. And we think one of the catalysts could very well be America defaulting on the debt that we owe, especially the international debt, including to other countries. You'd see the dollar drop to, about 25% of its value or less in a matter of days.
Well, I understand the point you're making, and I think you could have something just as serious, but not do it quite like that way. Now, think about this. If you owed me $10 and that was a lot of money for you, but inflation hit 1,000%, and you only had to work a half hour to make $10, let me make it even better. $100, a day's work for somebody.
Uh-huh.
Inflation, like you get in the old German Weimar Republic where you're taking barrels of cash. Well, some people still got to work then. And those people, instead of making $100 in a day or 100 marks in a day, had to get paid $100 in an hour. Well, if you're in debt, as the U.S. is, and you have this amazing amount of debt, one of the easiest ways to pay off the debt is to inflate your currency, hyperinflation, and then it's easier for you to pay because you still have some things you can sell. You're selling corn. There's still some products we export out of this country, and you can generate that money. But that's how you do it. You don't default. You go into hyperinflation. Now, you're not going to be able to sell your bonds when you're in hyperinflation, but the rest of the world's going down the tubes when that happens anyway.
Well, the only way we can continue to pay the debt, if things were to go extremely south, would simply be to print money. Wouldn't we hit a point where countries like China and Japan would say, look, we don't want your money. We want we want to get paid. We don't want the debt. And next thing you know, they see themselves in a situation where our currency is devalued so much that they're getting pennies on the dollar, 50% of their money, for example, and all of a sudden all the countries and all the international investors are saying, I'd better go ahead and get what I can before it isn't worth a thing, and you got a complete run on American currency, debt, etc.
That's true. By the way, what's your first name?
My name's Paul.
Okay, Paul. Now, that's true, but the thing is, when it hits that point, those countries go south too. Because we're still the largest consumer in the world. China is not capable of being a consumer nation to the level that we are yet. So when we go south, China's economy goes in the toilet too. Now, Russia, they're rich in raw resources, so that might be a slightly different situation. But their economy is not as big as one would think. But they are very cash rich because of their energy resources.
You know, we also, another thing that I think is important for people to keep an eye on is that there are certain people that have money in this country, and even people that just have a little bit of money but have some, that are starting to get concerned enough to where they're beginning to invest even in money markets overseas that involve the Europe, Swiss accounts and like that, because even people that are here with money are starting to get a little bit jittery about where we stand financially. That's got to be a warning sign.
That's true, and there has been that kind of flight. But as I said, I don't think it's going to be that bad per se, but I think the American taxpayers are going to get the biggest bill they've ever had in their lives, and the living standard of this is the best case scenario, in my opinion. The living standard of Americans is just going to plummet. But it is possible things could be even worse. And Paul, thanks for the call. I want to give some of this other information out over the air, though.
I sure appreciate it. Y'all have a good day.
Thank you. Okay. And again, what triggered this conversation was the fact that the Fed organized this $200 billion cash fund or liquidity fund, credit, in concert with the Bank of London, with the European Bank. That's $200 billion. The biggest since the Depression, I think, is what I actually read there a minute ago. You go back to it.
Yeah, you said since the 30s.
Boldest action since the Depression. But you got to remember, this is $200 billion on top of the $50 billion from about a week or two ago, and the $50 billion before
right.
that,
right.
and the $100 billion over in Europe. Because before that, we had about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, didn't we have the big headline, the biggest injection of funds into the financial system since 9/11?
Right.
So now that's our benchmark. It was 9/11 was the biggest thing since the Depression. Now we got the biggest thing since the Depression. Banks to seize Carlyle Capital assets. The likely liquidation of Carlyle Capital Corp's remaining assets sent the fund's share plummeting more than 90% Thursday and rattled stock markets around the globe. It was also a high-profile setback for private. Now this
Who sits on the Carlyle board of directors?
Every rich elitist globalist in the world, practically.
Can you please name some names that will be?
Well, I don't know who sits on it now, but John Major, the former Prime Minister of London, mm-hmm. Frank Carlucci, former Defense Secretary here in the U.S. We've got the Bin Ladens were in on it. The Saudi royal family. The Bushes were. A lot of them have gotten out because
they knew.
But and this is why I said municipal bonds. You can't even trust the municipal bonds because a lot of these municipal governments have been buying stuff from Carlyle Capital.
Right.
Just like that fund that we had in from Lehman Brothers that went belly up after Jeb Bush pimped them out to the state government. Feb foreclosures up 60%. By the way, I know pimped out is a derogatory word. When he acted as a consultant to Lehman Brothers in his new private position outside of government.
I like pimped out better.
February foreclosures up 60% from last year. That continue. We won't go back into that. Now, this is what I wanted to read, and you know, maybe next week I'll have time to really go in deep on this. This is an article by Mike Whitney. What it really is, a vicious circle ending in a systemic financial meltdown. Now, they talk about what we were just talking about, the bailout, about that being an act of desperation, that the Fed Reserve Chairman is running out of tricks in his bag. The actual members of the global banking cartel that participated in this was the Bank of Canada, Bank of England, European Central Bank, Federal Reserve, and Swiss National Bank. They put together something called the Team Securities Lending Facility. And, again, I won't go into the details. I just want to get to the bottom here. I want to do two things here. Let's see who. This is Steve Waldman, and because it's such a lengthy article, I'm trying to find his credentials. But after the repo program and TSLF, the Fed will have between $300 billion and $400 billion in remaining sterilization capacity. In other words, something that can help, unless it issues bonds directly, which is something that could be coming in. That would be a hyperinflationary event, if the Fed starts just issuing its own bonds, because they do have that in their charter. They can be the bank of last resort, which is why they can give money for crappy securities in the name of $200 billion. Bernanke is running short of ammo, and the housing bust has just begun. As the wave of foreclosures, credit card defaults, and commercial real estate bankruptcy continue to mount, Bernanke's bag of tricks will be near empty. Just jumping a little bit. That's only half the story. Bernanke and company are already working on a new list of hyperinflationary remedies once the credit troubles pop up again, according to the Wall Street Journal. The Fed has another economy-busting scams up its sleeve, it goes on to say. Now, the last bit here, which is a couple long paragraphs, but economist Norio Rubini was giving testimony before Congress just about 6 months ago. And this is what he said 6 months ago. There is now a rising probability of a catastrophic financial and economic outcome, a vicious circle where a deep recession makes financial losses more severe, and where in turn large and growing financial losses and a financial meltdown make the recession even more severe. The Fed is seriously worried about this vicious cycle and about the risk of a systemic financial meltdown. I'll jump down to the bottom here because probably goes a little deep. To understand the risk that the financial system is facing today, remember this is congressional testimony that this economist gave, I present the nightmare catastrophic scenario that the Fed and the financial officials around the world are now worried about. Such a scenario, however extreme, has rising and significant probability of occurring. That says rising significant probability of occurring. Thus, it does not describe a very low probability event, but rather an outcome that is quite possible. Not a cheery thought. And I wonder where Sarasota Dave. I sent him this article. I even sent Alan this article. You've got the article in your inboxes. I have to figure out how we can get this to more people who want to check this out. Anyway, 941-745-1490. And, what do you want to talk about next? Campaign or Iraq?
Let's talk about the campaign.
I think we've taken the trough down a little bit. But anyway, so the investment advisors that are saying just dollar cost average into the market, you'll be the way you get out of this.
That just makes you want to slip my wrist.
Is two things: you inflate your currency to make your effective debt easier to pay, and the other thing is, you find a way to make the American taxpayer pay $1 on the dollar for stuff that's only worth 20 or 30 cents on the dollar. Because that's the other thing you're hearing more and more now, is letting the Fed buy these mortgage securities, which effectively it just did with $200 billion.
Right.
But it's going to need a whole lot more of your tax money funneled into it to make that happen. And all right, let's lighten things up a little bit.
Sure news, talk about the campaign.
Yeah, we got the Red State Good Update part. Boys take us into the campaign segment of this. And they had a lot to say about that recent Hillary attack ad on Obama. Oh, now I got to refresh. Who was that?
Valerie.
Oh. Yeah.
It's always nice to see Valerie than Big Ed, huh?
Yes. All right. I think we have a chance to do this now.
Hi, and welcome to Red State Update. My name's Dutchie Bowles.
I'm Dunlap, and you may be wondering about our new environs. We're up in Nashville in a hotel room where we are working on a top-secret Red State Update project.
What the hell's secret about it?
Because I don't want to tell nobody what it is.
Why don't you want to tell nobody what it is?
Because I'm trying to build it up.
Don't nobody give a damn what the hell we're doing in Nashville.
I know, I'm trying to add some suspense.
Oh, hell, don't make no damn difference when
you
say something.
You've got to ignore Jackie. He's in a terrible mood.
I ain't in a terrible mood.
Because you can no longer smoke in hotel rooms.
I don't know what the hell happened. I'm in a hotel room not smoking for. What the hell is Nashville turning a damn nothing to me?
Why don't you go outside and smoke your damn cigarette?
I ain't going to go outside like a damn animal. Might as well use a bathroom out there too while I'm at it.
Oh my God. He's also mad because there's only one bed in the room, and I called it when I walked in.
Oh, hell, you can have a damn bed. I sleep on a damn floor.
You get up in here with me.
I ain't getting in
your room.
I ain't getting in bed with you. The hell with that.
Why not?
What
I ain't going to try nothing.
I ain't going to try nothing. I don't want to be nowhere near in a damn bed, hell.
What have you heard?
What?
There's some rumors going around that I don't like.
I don't know what the hell you talk about.
And rumors. I didn't start.
What?
All right, folks, listen. Like everybody up there talking about that new Hillary Clinton campaign ad.
Oh, hell.
One with the phone and the kids asleep. Hey, let's just go ahead and show a little bit of that.
It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone in the White House and it's ringing. Something's happening in the world. Your vote will decide who answers that call. Whether it's someone who already knows the world's leaders, knows the military, someone tested and ready to lead in a dangerous world.
What?
I don't understand. What's the point of her commercial? She can answer the phone?
Yeah.
She's running for president of the United States, not receptionist.
That don't make her no better. Obama can answer a phone. Hell, I know he can do that. I don't understand that. Don't make it no damn bit of sense to me. Hell.
It doesn't to me either.
And I tell you the worst thing about that. There's a children asleep calling that late, waking those children up. That's pitiful. Children asleep, you don't have to be calling that late at night, waking them up.
The phone ain't ringing in the house where the kids are.
Huh?
Phone's ringing in the White House.
Now, if I had children that age, what I'd say is, you know, don't call after 9 o'clock. If they got kids asleep, don't wake them up. Because sometimes they get young, they get up, get riled up, can't put them back to bed.
The phone ain't ringing where the kids are.
That don't make no sense. What the hell they saying the kids asleep for then? I don't understand it.
The phone is ringing in Washington while the kids are asleep.
No, I've seen that movie. How they call up and I had you check the children, the babysitter running up there, and the kids get killed, something like that. It's pitiful. I don't know what. Don't make no sense to me, hell.
Anyway, then Obama come out with his ad saying, I can answer a phone, too.
Yeah.
What the hell? Oh, next, we going to say you can send a fax the fastest?
I guess so.
And, of course, we know Obama would love to answer a 3 o'clock telephone call from Mama Dina, Jad. Oh, did I wake you up? No, I was just sitting here waiting on your call.
Yeah, he loves to talk to bad guys. Yeah,
he's got all the axis of evil in his top five.
Yeah, I'm pitiful. I'm sick of it. I don't care. Anybody care about the damn phone, hell.
Jeez, calm down.
Oh, you calm down. I'm getting the hell out of here.
I'm getting sleep.
I don't care if you get your damn sleep. I'm going to go broke your damn cigarette.
Hey, if you see that Mexican woman out there, tell her I need some more towels.
These guys have to be the funniest clowns out there.
RedStateUpdate.com. You can find it for yourself there.
All right, campaign, Henry. What's your thoughts?
Well, let's just do a quick recap. I won't read through all this, but McCain's hinting as Mitt Romney as a possible vice president.
Oh, that's a good one for us, I think.
Geraldine Ferraro.
I'd love to see him with Mitt. That's easy.
Geraldine Ferraro stepping down from
How is she stepping down if she was never a part of it?
She's part of the financing committee.
Yeah, but see, I'm confused there, you know.
She raised $125,000.
No, not that part. The first part is Hillary said, you know, she doesn't work for me, she has no part, but she's stepping down. I don't get it. I'm sorry, Henry. This semantics game that the Clintons have is just about damn ridiculous. Now, I don't care what Geraldine Ferraro said. I think it was ridiculous statements, to quote Obama. I don't think she's a racist. Now, that's ridiculous. And by the way, nobody from the Obama campaign called her a racist. That's good spin. Geraldine Ferraro, she's a good spinner.
So you think it was racist?
No, not at all. Absolutely, it was just a stupid statement. That's not a racist statement. You know, you could say something that's not politically correct without being a racist. I just think it was
stupid. And what did she say?
She said that the only reason he's there is because he's a black man.
Slightly different. If he wasn't black, right, he wouldn't be there.
It has racial undertones, but I don't think she's a racist. You know what I mean? I think what's happening is I think they're starting to get a little bit angry. They're in a corner. The person who was supposed to win the nomination, everybody thought she was going to win. She's not winning anymore. And you got to, you know, these women that grew up in that generation, my mom's one of them, you know, they fought hard for what they have. You know, basically they were working in a man's world. I think they saw a lot of the of these years of fighting that glass ceiling. You know, you can't hold that against them, and I think they see it slipping away. What I think Geraldine Ferraro was missing, though, is that when I keep talking about that generational gap, people my age, I don't care what color they are or what gender they are. It's really it's irrelevant to me.
How hot they are.
No, I you know, when I first heard, the first time I saw him was in 2004, and I thought, oh my God, this guy is brilliant. Had nothing to do with his color. Look, I'm not a black man, I'm not a white man, I'm not a woman, and I'm not a white woman. Obviously, I don't really have a dog in this fight. But since 2004, he speaks to me. I understand what he's saying. You know, it's ridiculous. That, you know, here's the thing, and I've heard callers say it. They're behind Hillary because she's a woman. They're behind Barack because he's a black man. To me, that's how can you vote for somebody because of their gender or their race or ethnicity? That's just ridiculous. And I think that's what's happening. It's a generational gap. I think the baby boomers don't understand what we want as the younger culture. I mean, the younger people coming in power now. I don't care what somebody. It's not of any importance to us. You know, voting for Hillary because she's a woman. Okay, so
let's go to the phone lines.
I don't get it.
You're live on the air.
Yeah. Good morning. This is Mike.
Mike, I listened to that CD.
Oh yeah, it's pretty strange, isn't it?
Yeah, you're a sick person.
Did you read the book?
No, I haven't read the book yet.
Oh, well, that's
worse. Tell the audience what the book is about.
Do you want me to?
Yes.
Well, it's this Frenchman named Le Petit Homme, who from the turn of the century, who performed at the Moulin Rouge to sell-out crowds. I mean, he really sold the place out.
What was his instrument?
He was the most famous performer of all times for that era, and his act consisted of farting. I mean, that's what he did. He could blow a candle out from, 3 foot away. And when he performed in front of men only, he had this little tuxedo flap, and he'd pull it off the back of him so that people could see there was no trickery involved. And when he performed in front of a mixed audiences with women, he would leave the flap on there to be modest.
For all of you ex-GIs out there.
Why have I not jumped and read that book yet?
For all the GIs that visited the Philippines, I think I have a visual of what went on.
My goodness.
Yeah, but it's a real interesting book. I mean, the guy's really amazing.
What else is on your mind?
There's a modern version of it called Mr. Methane. If you put Mr. Methane, type it into Google, it'll take you to Mr. Methane website or different little videos about Mr. Methane, and it's also very hilarious.
Yeah, that gives me an idea. If you could teach a cow on command, man, you could make $1 million probably.
What's up this morning,
Mike? Yeah,
Mike,
what else is on your mind?
Well, I couldn't, I don't know. I think we forget, but I get reminded sometimes what a really racist society we live in. And I know people will swear up and down, oh, that's just not true. But I listen to talk radio whenever I'm in the car or in my truck. And yesterday after work, driving home, I turned on Michael Medved. Mm. They all said the same thing. Schnitt, same thing. Okay, in the evening I was driving somewhere. Sean Hannity, same exact thing. They were going on and on and on about Barack Obama's preacher at his church and that sermon that he gave.
Right.
And they were so shocked. You know, I mean, this is the most racist thing I've ever heard of in my life. I just can't believe it. It just disgusts me.
You know what's funny, Mike, is I'm reminded every time I do something or I speak up and I do a forum or a debate, I'm reminded the day after when I get my emails how racist the United States is. I get a lot of them. It doesn't surprise me whatsoever. I think the when somebody's oppressed for between 200 and 400 years, it's kind of hard to blame them for being a little angry, Mike. Would you agree with me?
You know, I agree with you 100%. I mean, I just, I grew up in a different area, so I'm a little more used to it than the people here, maybe, but I don't know. I just, I was really, it really hit me right in the face.
Yeah, and that's what I was kind of getting to, the fact that one of the things about, as it goes on from generation to generation, you know, we still have hang-ups, but I see the way my children interact with other children, and it's kind of a nice thing, Mike, when I see them, because the hang-ups that we grew up with, it seems like they have less of them. And I think the issue is hopefully from generation to generation as it goes on, people have the less hang-ups where they come to homosexuality, as in our great show from 3 to 5 Reality Check. That I have a feeling they might be gay. I really do. I think Miami might be gay because all they talk about is just anti-gay sentiment. So I think Miami Mike's a little gay. I think he might have experimented with the old, I have a feeling.
All right, Peter, please, go ahead.
I was going to ask you guys if you're going to play Reverend Wright today. You're not playing any?
I'm having trouble playing some of my audio.
Hey, I have a question for you.
Wait,
Peter, before you get started, do you think that his statements were historically wrong?
Historically, yeah.
You do? You don't think there's racism in America?
He damned the country. He damned the country as a whole, That's probably the most inflammatory.
Right, statements wrong?
Let's take it up Monday.
No, they weren't.
Because we're going to have
his statements were wrong. He said we deserve what happened on 9/11.
All right. Let's take it up Monday
that.
When we can play the. I'm not prepared with the statements here. I'll let me work on the computer.
Okay.
Because we got other things we got to talk about here. Thank you both, guys.
I just want to know if America knows out there what happened in 1953 in Iran and Mozadeek and how we basically tried to overthrow government and we're feeling the consequences now.
All right. Let's finish up with the campaign and we'll take it to Howard Dean right now.
Gentlemen, it's now time for a message from the Democratic National Committee Chairman. He's from the Green Mountain State. He is endorsed by the Green Party, and if he's ever elected, it'll truly be a green day. Please give me a whoop, whoop, whoop for Howard Dean!
I go on TV shows just making sure that I am still well known. Dean is on the go and urging me to run. I am alone. Out on the campaign trail, they all disregard outspoken Dean. And white Christian males, they fear the day that I sit on the throne. I walk alone, I'm on my own. One thing is known, I'll shock ya. My ego's the only thing on stage beside me. Mess with me and you're gonna get a beating. Sometimes I cannot hide the rage inside me. And then a tantrum thrown. They're talking out their ears when they say I don't have a full deck. Sometimes it appears that I really just don't have a neck. Read between the lines, in 2008 I'll reign supreme. Now I've used my time, but I think that you need to hear me scream. Yeah, yeah. House should go to Democrats, you know it. The voters want change and the polls all show it. Somehow when Dean's involved, we always blow it. We'll find a way to lose.
The best way to avoid an accident-related injury is to avoid the accident. Slow down, drive defensively, and please wear your seatbelt. If you've been injured in an accident, you probably have questions. How will I pay the doctors? What if I'm out of work? Who will fix my car? You may not know where to turn. You're inundated with TV and radio commercials. You may even have received letters from lawyers or doctors. At Callan's Little Delgado and Opstal, we understand how confusing an accident can be, and we want to help answer your questions. Call us today at 941-749-1446. One of our attorneys will meet with you and help answer any questions that you have. There's no charge to meet with us, and our fees are based on a percentage of what we recover for you. I'm Scott Callens at Callan's Little Delgado. And Opstal. We work hard serving our clients and our community. Call us at 941-749-1446 and let us help answer your questions. Callan's Little Delgado and Opstal are proud sponsors of the Manatee County YMCA. For more information, call us at 941-749-1446 or reach us at makeempay.net.
Oh, I can't face another day of pain.
You don't have to suffer in pain another day. Dr. Owen McCarthy, specializing in orthopedics and sports medicine, has been bringing relief to sufferers of arthritis, auto accidents, work-related injuries, and sports injuries for over 30 years. A board-certified physician, Dr. McCarthy will take a conservative, cautious approach to your treatment, but he will get you relief. With offices in Bradenton and Sun City Center, Dr. Owen McCarthy can treat patients anywhere in our broadcast area. Give him a call today at 941-795-3844. 941-795-3844. Accepting Medicare, most commercial insurances, and private payers. Give Dr. McCarthy a call, 941-795-3844.
You're listening to an American AM, the voice of the Sheeple Liberation Front.
It's American AM. I'm your host, Henry Raines. With me in the broadcast studio, attorney Jim Delgado. Just wanted to do a quick update before we go to our guest. Headline, public is less aware of Iraq casualties, studies find. 28% of the public is aware that nearly 4,000 U.S. personnel have died in Iraq over the past 5 years, while nearly half thinks the death tally is 3,000 or fewer, and 23% think it is higher, according to an opinion survey released yesterday. The other opinions that have been in flux is the idea that the surge has improved things and that, in a lot of ways, it takes a while for the public to catch up with the curve. And right now we have a situation of rising violence in Iraq after a decline. Let me just review some events here that have happened in the last 48 hours, starting with McClatchy. Baghdad, 5 civilians wounded when an IED exploded in the local marketplace. That was at 9. Mortar rounds hit the green zone at 11:15 a.m. No casualties. 3 unidentified bodies found in Baghdad by Iraq police today. Kame Afi, a media assistant at the local newspaper, gunned down by the National Theater. Roadside bomb targeted U.S. military convoy on Kanat Street at 11 a.m. No casualties reported. In Diyala, a civilian was killed by gunmen near Al-Farouq Mosque, central Baqaba this morning. Salahuddin, a gunman killed 3 Awakening Council members and kidnapped 4 from a location. One policeman killed 2 Salihwa members, that is the Awakening Council, also injured by the attack. Gunmen attack a checkpoint manned by support forces of Baji and kidnapped 4. Kirkuk, a suicide bomber, detonated the afternoon in Zab District, West Kirkuk, killing 3 civilians, injuring 7. One civilian killed, 10 injured when a car bomb exploded on a highway between Kirkuk City and Rashad District. 3 Iraq Army soldiers injured when an IED exploded, and that is just scratching the surface because as we continue within the last 48 hours near Diwaniya, 1 U.S. soldier killed and 2 wounded by a roadside bomb. Baghdad, roadside bomb killed 2 people. Roadside bomb wounded 5 people. 3 mortar rounds landed in Baghdad's green zone. Mortar rounds wounded 3 people in Shab District near Kirkuk. Roadside bomb targeted a local council member near Kirkuk. Basra gunman shot and killed a former official of Saddam Hussein's bath party. Senior figure in the Shiite cleric, Ms. Mikhail Asar, shot dead. Near Samarra, 3 fuel truck drivers killed with 3 roadside bombs went off near a convoy. Mosul, 6 fuel trucks were set ablaze. 3 drivers were wounded on Tuesday. And continuing, 9 a.m. yesterday, roadside bomb targeted an American patrol. 9:15, roadside bomb targeted an American patrol. 10 a.m., an American patrol defused a roadside bomb. 10:10, a roadside bomb targeted an American patrol. Around 10:30 a.m., a roadside bomb targeted an American patrol. Police found 4 dead bodies in Baghdad. Diyala found 1 dead body. Around 1:50 p.m., mortars hit Cannon Village. Police found a dead body on the way between Kunin and east of Baqaba. Baqaba Morgue delivered today 2 dead bodies. 2:10 p.m., a 10-year-old girl was killed. 7:25, an IED exploded at a farm. And I actually got to cut it short because the list is going on, and there is currently...
Things are going much better.
Yes, and we
it's
have...
Safe, like the recruiters say, it's safer than living in Detroit City.
And right now there is battles going on in Kut between Mahdi Army militiamen and Iraqi U.S. troops, and there's probably a breakaway group from Muqtada al-Sadr, as they said. Well... That is all just to sort of set the plate for our next guest and article that he recently wrote. Raj Perowat is interim director at Citizens for Global Solutions, a grassroots membership organization that envisions a future in which nations work together. He is also, he's also recently been the director of the International Law and Justice Program at the Center for Global Solutions, and heads the Foreign Policy for 21st Century Initiative. Prior to that, he was Legislative Director for Human Rights First and has a lengthy experience in matters such as this. The website of interest is globalsolutions.org, and let us welcome back Raj Perowit to American AM, and thank you for making time for us this morning.
It's good to be back on the air with you guys.
Yes, and you recently had an op-ed that was published having to tie in with our presidential election, but also with Iraq, and that, of course, was is linked to, I believe, at the Global Solutions website, and you about Obama's recently resigned foreign policy advisor, Samantha Powers. But before we do that, tell us a little bit more about Center for Global Solutions.
Sure. Citizens for Global Solutions, we're a membership organization based in the United States, and we advocate for a U.S. foreign policy that is multilateral in nature and seeks to effectively use international institutions, strong relationships with our allies, and a framework of international law to deal with the range of challenges from Iraq to Darfur and beyond that no one country, including the United States, can handle on its own. So that's really what we try to do.
And before you remind us of why Samantha Power is in hot water or was in hot water, tell us a little bit more about her.
Yeah, I think the link between the reason we wrote the piece on Samantha Power, and I should sort of say up front that Citizens for Global Solutions has not endorsed any of the three sort of remaining candidates for president, and we're not likely to do so. And I've actually never met Samantha Power. I've read her book on the Rwandan genocide and sort of the failures of the Clinton administration during that period of time, but never met her. The point in the op-ed, the sort of defense of Samantha Power, is more and really squares with the comments you made at the beginning of this segment. So from our perspective, there are a range of very, very serious challenges that the United States is facing right now in the foreign policy arena, from Iraq to Darfur to something much closer to home, our relationships in this hemisphere with Latin America and the Caribbean. There are a range of challenges that are before us, and to date, the types of advisors that people are making policy in Washington, D.C., it's been much of a muchness. It's the same old folks making the same old statements. We need to shake things up a little bit. And our point was that, yes, look, Samantha Power should not have made the comment she did,
which was
she called Senator Clinton a monster for her campaign strategy in Ohio. But from our perspective, if we are going to take this election seriously, all of the candidates and the media need to sort of be able to say, yes, that was an overstep, that was a mistake. She apologized right away, frankly, before I think most people even knew the comment had happened. But we need people like that in the debate for their expertise. Samantha Power is somebody who is a brilliant foreign policy thinker, but frankly a little bit different to some of the folks who've been in and around government for the last 20-odd years. So our point was not to say narrowly this is the Clinton administration, the Clinton campaign sort of being hypersensitive or the like, but rather let's have a debate where different ideas, different individuals are brought into the process to take on some of these big sort of foreign policy challenges. And if it means that we've got to kind of dial down our hypersensitivity on some of these back and forth tit-for-tat comments, that's okay. It's amazing to me that I think in the minute and a half that you spent going through all of the recent attacks, deaths, injuries in Iraq, I'm pretty confident that the folks over at, say, CNN, MSNBC, spent maybe 10, 20, 30 times as much time on the Samantha Power story over the last couple of weeks than they did those issues. And I think that's there's all that's wrong about the way this campaign has been covered, and also I think the way some within these campaigns are approaching these issues.
We're speaking with Raj Perowit. He is the interim director of Citizens for Global Solutions. The website is globalsolutions.org. Raj, I'm sort of very much in the minority when I talk to people about who they're going to vote for, because I almost always say, well, because the cliche is, I vote for the person. I don't vote for the party. I don't this or that. And I'm like, I always vote for the person around the person. And who he, what constituencies they represent. Yeah, and this Samantha Power, and actually she was very salty in her language. I think she said, we effed up in Ohio. And not the best soundbite or quote you give to a newspaper journalist, but she's unusual in that she's...
honest?
Well, that, but I mean...
Outspoken?
All that stuff, but you know...
Non-PC.
Jumping the gun on me.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Anyway, she was born in Great Britain. She's relatively young as a foreign policy advisor.
Absolutely.
A Pulitzer Prize winner. She started out as a journalist, I believe, beyond her academic career, and then has become a Jane of all trades, I guess, on this. What kind of philosophy do you think she brings to the Obama camp? Because even if she's gone now, if he wins, it's likely, because I believe she worked with him, too, in his Senate office, that she will be part of the administration.
Yeah, she worked for him when he was in his Senate office, that's correct. I think a piece of sort of the Samantha Power kind of philosophy, and I certainly don't want to speak for her writing and thinking, because she's certainly prolific in that regard, but the book that really, I think, she won the Pulitzer Prize for sort of looking at the Rwanda genocide and the mistakes made there, I think is instructive. I think it was that some of the points she made in that book were that the Clinton administration had an opportunity to probably stop the Rwandan genocide before it really got started, either working through the United Nations or using technology such as our ability to jam the radios that were used by the Interahamwe militia to actually mobilize the death gangs in Rwanda. There are a range of different things we could have done that didn't necessarily require putting U.S. troops on the ground in Rwanda. These were sort of would fall short of that. But I think her point was that there was an opportunity to use the tools that were available, and we could have made a significant difference in a genocide that led to the death of 800,000 people. So I think that if Samantha Power had been in the White House in 1994, and if it had been a President Obama, if we want to sort of continue that hypothetical, I think we would have seen U.S. action on Rwanda, and I'm not sure whether that would have included simply sort of supporting UN peacekeepers, which would have probably been enough, plus use of technology or perhaps even some smaller capacity on the ground. I'm not sure what range of tactics would have been used, but there's no doubt about it. We would have been, I think, played a much more sort of aggressive and leading role on that issue. If you look at some of the other folks around the Obama campaign, and I may not necessarily agree with all of the things they say, but again, there are some contrarian voices, some people suggesting that U.S. policy vis-a-vis Cuba needs to be rethought a little bit. Now, that's, I know, down there in Florida can be a controversial point to bring up, but I would submit that if you are focused on Cuba and care about it, the fact that really not much has changed on that island over the last sort of 40-odd years, there's a case to be made, so let's think about some things a little bit differently. Or if you look at Senator Obama himself and some of the comments that he's made looking towards South Asia, again, things are a little bit different. So, again, you don't have to agree with all of these things, but I think the point of the article that my colleague Rich Stasinski and I wrote was that the piece highlighted, Samantha Power illustrates for us the importance of having different voices around a candidate, because that's the way you're going to get some different thinking in Washington, and we desperately need it. It's interesting that in this morning's Washington Post, you've got General Petraeus, who's sort of the U.S. man on the ground, leading the surge in Iraq, saying that, look, the Iraqis have not taken advantage of the political space that has been created by the surge. Now, at Citizens for Global Solutions, we oppose the invasion of Iraq, and our sort of policy on it now is that you've got to look at a solution in a much broader framework. We kind of echo the direction of the Iraq study group, saying you almost need to look for a grand bargain-type strategy to the region, a political way out of this mess that involves having tough conversations with some folks who we may not like, just about the issues we care about, but the issues that, frankly, motivate them.
Well, sunshine may be shining on that, Raj, because Dick Cheney's going to the Middle East on a peace mission.
Oh, there you go. I feel relieved and warm and fuzzy all over.
Is he taking a shotgun with him?
You know, seriously, though, I mean, because these are serious issues. From this administration, sending a guy like Vice President Cheney to the Middle East, it doesn't necessarily get us anywhere. I mean, it's a useful photo op, and and the like, but it doesn't suggest any kind of businesses as sort of, it just suggests business as normal. There's no differences there. There's no, it doesn't change the tone, shake things up, suggest that, look, we're going to try another set of tactics to deal, to address the security challenges in the greater Middle East. That's, and I think we need some changes there.
We're speaking with Raj Perowat, Citizens for Global Solutions Interim Director, website globalsolutions.org. We'll take phone calls, too, at 941-745-1490, 941-745-1490. Jim, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, Raj, it was my understanding that the Clinton administration was approached by Darfur way before the, 200, 300 million casualties, or 200, 300,000 casualties.
Sorry, I missed the first part of that. You said
yeah,
Clinton
was... It was my understanding that the Clinton administration was approached by Darfur before the numbers got so great, and they refused to do anything about it.
Well, I think in terms of sort of the kind of Sudan / Darfur, the situation there, the violence in the past has been more focused on southern Sudan, and that's certainly a problem that extended back a number of years, including during both the first and second Clinton term. When the Bush administration came to office in 2001, they did initially make some really good progress on the North-South Sudan conflict that had led to many, many people being killed. Former Senator Danforth played a role as an envoy and really helped to bring a ceasefire and some stability to that. The problem that the Bush administration ran into, or the mistake that they made, was they never followed up with that and sort of the hard diplomacy to keep that North-South agreement in place. And then when the violence really started ratcheting up in Darfur, they didn't initially, although they ended up sort of using the right words, former Secretary of State Powell called it genocide, they didn't actually get involved in a meaningful way, in a diplomatic way. And there are a number of different reasons or put forward for why that may have been. Some suggest just to focus on Iraq instead of this area. Others suggest that they were worried that the North-South deal with war time. Whatever it is, you now have a situation in Sudan where the Darfur region is sort of in flames, and you've had at least 200, 250,000 people dead, and you know, hundreds of thousands more have been displaced. The North-South Sudan peace agreement is falling apart. The government in Khartoum that is kind of fighting with South Sudan and the folks in Darfur, they're feeling, I think, pretty good about pushing their set of policies forward. And then you've got surrounding countries being pulled into this. You've got, you know, Chad now, you know, suffering from this. And this is a real problem. So I think for them, hopefully this administration and their waning months will recommit and try and get end their term in office the way they began it, with taking the situation in Sudan seriously, and that would include Darfur. It may well be that, and I think very likely, that the next administration will have to deal with Darfur, North-South Sudan, as well as a host of other problems as well. And for that, I think we're going to need some people who can think around, and I think you're right, there's got to be people around the president who think a little bit differently, are willing to push and suggest different approaches to these challenges.
Raj, we're going to do like a two-part question here with me on one part and Jim on the other part. It's probably going to take up all our time. We only have about 3 to 4 minutes left. But speaking of some of the problems in Africa, whether you're talking about Rwanda or Darfur, aren't there global economic interests that don't want to see strong states develop that can provide the security for their people? Because from my limited reading, in the case of Rwanda, different militia groups get control of some of these natural resources. There's some, I forget the name of the mineral, but it's so important in cell phones and in computers in that area. And I've read what the corporations are buying this stuff for, something that's such a important component on such a big global market consumer item. It's just pennies on the dollar, if even that, for what the companies get out of it. So isn't it in some of these corporations' interest to see that chaos, as long as there's at least a militia that can get the minerals out of there? And in the case of Darfur, you're talking about getting down towards the headwaters of the Nile River. Water is going to be a huge resource. If there's strong nations there, they'll form a treaty and get control of their own resources, one of the most important resources of the world. And I think that leads to Jim's question.
Yeah, and I guess I'm trying to figure out. I know that when it first started, the Arabs were tagged as the bad guys. But the more I read about it, it seems like there's a big problem between who's the good guys or the bad guys, the Arabs or the Africans. It seems like they're jumping sides, going back and forth, who's the bad guy, who's the good guy.
Yeah, I think those are both very good questions. Maybe you may quickly sort of take the second part first and then get to the first part. In terms of Darfur, there's actually been this kind of misnomer out there that this has been between the sort of the Arabs and the Africans in Darfur and Sudan. The reality is that all of these individuals are all of the same faith, they're all Muslim. There has been, from a kind of ethnicity standpoint, frankly, most people wouldn't be able to figure out who would fall under the, quote, Arab side or the, quote, African side. What you've ended up seeing, though, is the government in Khartoum that running Sudan and really running this genocide in Darfur, they have sought to use these labels to define essentially people who are with them and those are sort of, you know, who they oppose. And you're right that a big piece of this in Sudan and then more broadly in Africa is resource-based. In Sudan, one of the great problems you've had in the north-south site and then now with Darfur is that these areas sort of peripherally away from Khartoum have felt shortchanged. That, you know, resources are mined, extracted, pumped from their areas, benefits those in the capital, Khartoum, and the resources don't flow back down. There's no kind of equitable distribution, and this has been a real problem, and this has helped to sort of destabilize things that have led to the violence. If you look at places like the Congo, where you see coltan, I think, is the ore that you were talking about, and this is used in, you're right, in cell phones, computers, a range of things. The Congo is probably one of the great tragedies. The DRC has, you've seen millions of people who have been killed there over a long period of time. And part of the problem you have got there, or the main problem you've got there, is it's a resource-rich country that has a very weak central government, and it's a huge country. So you've got literally countries and private entities, mining groups, others in and around that country seeking to essentially pillage it, and they're willing to sacrifice hundreds of thousands of people to get hands on resources. I mean, the most extreme example.
Rog, I'm afraid we're out of time. I'm very sorry. It's just got a minute to get out of here. But Rog Perowit is the interim director of the Citizens for Global Solutions. You can find out more about all the issues he's talking about if you go to globalsolutions.org. Rog, it was great to have you with us. I'm glad you could make it in such short notice.
Thanks so much. Look forward to chatting to you guys again.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, we could have spent an hour with him. Too bad.
Yeah, Rog Perowit, thanks to him. Thanks to Jim Delgado.
Hey, big heads out of jail.
Callers and listeners.
I thought he was wrapped up in that whole Spitzer scheme. Big Ed's a quarter
what,
diamonder guy.
What?
He doesn't even get the diamond. He gets a quarter of a diamond.
Rather a Democrat screw the prostitute than us.
You know how you know it's a Democrat? Because it was a woman.
What Ed can
when
do
it's
with
a boy,
$5,000.
When it's a boy or a man, it's the other side.
Yeah, you'd be busy for years.
All right. I guess we're out.
Forget about by the hour. Coming up, Jay and Julie show. I believe it's, is it a live show today? Taped? And Rick on the radio, and lots of great stuff coming up. Oh, don't forget Jim's favorite reality check.
The Anti-Gay Show from 3 to 5 p.m. Get with God. He hates gays.
We'll be back Monday with another American AM.
Way down south is where we belong. We'll sit on the beach. We'll rip up the... So take my hand and follow me. Our future's filled with so many opportunities. And I go so far down.